I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the more fascinating books of the season is In the Valleys of the Noble Beyond, In Search of the Sasquatch. It looks at the mysterious creature, a hairy man-ape that people swear inhabits the wilderness. The book's author, John Zada, joined me recently to talk about the book, about his many travels, especially to Canada's Great Bear Rainforest, to seek out this creature itself, the science, as well as the mythos surrounding this beast that has captivated everybody, including scientists and storytellers. John Zada is a writer and photographer whose work has appeared in the Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, Explore, CBC, Al Jazeera, BBC, Los Angeles Review of Books, and other outlets. He is a writer at the CBC News Network and joined me from Toronto last month. JohnZada.com is the website for more. This new book is published by Greystone Books. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, John Zada. Mr. Zada, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, when I got your book in the summer, just before the summer, the first thing I thought about was, well, I don't really want to read about Sasquatch because it's something that, you know, that I'd heard of, obviously, and I didn't really buy into it, right?
Right.
And then I started reading it, and I thought, well, you know, it's just a beautiful book in terms of where you take the reader, all these mm-hmm. travels that you've made, or these fascinating people that you've talked to mm-hmm. who do buy into it, if you will, who do think Sasquatch exists. For you, I guess it began when you were growing up, right?
Yeah, I was, you know, of fairly competent reading age by around 8 or 9 years old, and that was in the late 70s, early 80s, and I started reading Sasquatch books. I was taken by my mom to the public library, and somehow I discovered, I guess, the unexplained section, or found it, or whatever, and just, you know, started reading these. They're basically the first sort of, you know, journalistic books that had come out on the subject, you know, chronicling people's eyewitness encounters by a writer named John Green, who used to live in Harrison Hot Springs. And so that, in conjunction with, you know, TV shows like In Search of the $6 Million Man, which had like Sasquatch episodes in them, the culture at the time was quite saturated with, you know, unexplained sort of, you know, media content. And so I think that had a really big effect on, you know, cultivating an interest in me in the topic.
Yeah, I guess my disinterest in it all had, I'm just slightly a little younger than you. And so, you know, I was 18. The internet was already around.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, is it a product of your time? The 70s and 80s, where, you know, these things couldn't be easily looked up, if you will, online, that mm-hmm. this sort of mythos sort of, I guess, was a lot more prevalent than it is today, say.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of that. I mean, I think that for some reason, and I don't know what it might be, just that time in history, the culture was open and opening up to these topics, and I guess there was a kind of an open-mindedness or you know, at that kind of juncture towards this kind of stuff, maybe perhaps coming out of the 60s where things really broke open in terms of people looking at alternative things, and then maybe this was the extension. But
right.
I mean, having said that, I think, too, that with the coming of the Internet, the topic has also exploded in popularity because it's put, you know, researchers, Bigfoot researchers, in contact with each other. They've been able to create their own websites,
yeah.
talk about reports in their own area. And so, I mean, I think that the Internet, although maybe in some way sort of cheapening the subject in a sense because it's made it so ubiquitous,
sure.
has also caused a lot of people to become very interested in it at the same time.
And then so as I'm reading the book, as I go on reading the book, you start looking at the science of it, all the scientific inquiry into Bigfoot and whether it exists. And then, you know, now I'm engrossed in the book and I'm thinking, you know, maybe something's up there. And so what have you found in terms of I mean, did your own thinking, how did that change, say, in the course of, say, growing up and then now writing this book and finishing it? And all
yeah,
the travels in between, of course.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's hard question to answer because I found my own thoughts on the matter they've tended to move and shift. I mean, obviously as a kid, I really, really did embrace it and really believe in it. And then, you know, even going into adulthood, as I abandoned the subject a little bit, you know, you go off to university, hanging out with your friends. But I still kept meeting people who claimed to have seen these animals, and sometimes people who were essentially lay people on the subject. They didn't know anything about Sasquatch. And so when I really kind of got into it and started doing my own research and traveling on the BC coast and talking to people, including some of the scientists the very small handful of scientists who study this stuff, it started to become even more compelling because, you know, one biologist in particular, Dr. John Bindernagel, who has recently passed, but who I hung out with during the course of my research, has, you know, showed me plaster casts and talked about, you know, the feet and the like the footprint and the morphology and the toes moving and this kind of thing. So when you're talking to a scientist, even though they're human and they're fallible and they have their own belief systems, it's still nonetheless compelling. And then, of course, the eyewitnesses, really reputable people, they live on the land, they know the animals. I mean, a lot of that really did build up into a really strong case for me. But then at the same time, of course, where are the bones, where are the fossils, where right. is the physical evidence? And you know, there is also the issue of human perception and how fallible it is. And so all of that has really kind of combined to, I guess, sort of leave me unsure, you know, at the end.
Right.
Like I lean towards it. I want there to be a Sasquatch. And then sometimes I really do feel that there is a reality to it. But then other times, I'm not quite so sure.
Yeah, that's the other thing that I was thinking about as I was reading the book, as I finished the book. It really does give one a chance to think about human beings themselves and think about us and why we are fascinated by Sasquatch. And I mean, we could draw conclusions, obviously, as to those who dismiss the idea as well as those who believe. But regardless, if one is fascinated with it, I mean, it says something about us, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's a lot to plumb there, right? And so, I mean, obviously, those who are in pursuit of the creature, on the surface anyway, in terms of their conscious rationalization, they are talking about, you know, trying to contribute knowledge to science, to find this mysterious animal, and to basically kind of, it's almost a kind of an exploration / scientific pursuit. It's an adventure, right? And we're driven by that. But at the same time, I mean, we as humans, we you know, we're often doing things for reasons that we aren't fully, you know, cognizant of. And I think that, you know, at one level, the Sasquatch is a really, really powerful symbol of the wild, let's say.
Yeah.
The receding wild, the threatened wild, the you know, a kind of almost unimaginable wild that perhaps existed at a time in our past. And I think on one level, we as a kind of race, even as individuals, we, by pursuing the creature, we're almost trying to grasp that sense of the wild that I think has left us. I think too, though, there is something almost quasi-religious about it. I mean, I think the creature, you know, appears, it disappears, it's almost impossible to find. It's like super fast, it's super elusive, it moves with unimaginable speed. It has almost these qualities of a deity or a demigod. And I think that at a really deep level, in a way, it's almost like a bit like UFOs or aliens in that sense, in that we're almost striving again to make contact with an intelligence that is, you know, beyond us. And
yeah.
So, even the scientists I find, you know, those that I've spoken to, including Bindernagel, I feel that they are almost affected by this almost kind of superhuman quality of the creature, and it exacts a hold over their imagination.
We've endowed so much of say, our own fears, as well as our aspirations, say, into this creature. You know, at once we admire how freer it is than we are, say, but then at the same time, we wonder about it. And so you mentioned Bindranagel, and he's fascinating to read about in your book because of the conversations that you have with him. Well, in terms of what motivated him and his work over the years, what was that?
Well, like all of us who become interested in the Sasquatch, he discovered it one day unexpectedly. He went for a haircut at the barber as an undergrad, and he, you know, picked up a magazine just at random on the table to go read while he was getting his haircut, and it happened to be this magazine called Argosy, which was this sort of men's adventure travel magazine, which had the story of Sasquatches in it, and so he became instantly fascinated. He was a wildlife management student at the University of Guelph in Ontario, and he brought up the question in one of his classes to his professor. And instantly when he posed the question, the entire class erupted in laughter, almost this kind of this cackling mockery of laughter, he described it to me. And then after the ruckus had died down, the professor had, you know, basically told him, you know, this is not a subject for a university classroom, and you're not going to bring it up ever again, kind of thing. He chided him, and I think it was that sort of, I guess, miniature trauma almost that compelled him to seek to go in search of this animal. And so, as he started his professional life years later, he made it a focus of study. At first on the side, at first quietly, but, you know, he was in the closet in a sense, but then slowly over time, he came out of the closet, started writing books about it, and his obsession towards the end of his life became, why are his scientific colleagues dismissing him to the extent that they are regarding this, when he sees reason for, you know, the topic to be investigated? And that's what really drove him in the end, was this kind of, you know, idea that, you know, how dare my other colleagues, like, you know, dismiss me for studying this? Well, I'm just being a scientist. That's what science is. We investigate things. And so that was his obsession.
You mentioned that he's since died. And he obviously spent a lifetime looking at this and thinking about this. Upon his death, were there any conclusions that he drew, or I mean, did he come any closer, say, to finding out what happened?
Well, I mean, nothing conclusive. I know that he did take some trips to the United States to visit researchers down there. I think one of the trips was in Kentucky, where there were a handful of people doing something called habituation studies, where they knew that there are Sasquatches in the area and they spend time there. Apparently the Sasquatch becomes acclimatized to the human presence and is not as, is more visible. So I he had mentioned that he'd gone down there and he thought that he had seen one at a distance with these people. But I think that may have been the closest sort of thing that had happened with him. But at the end of the day, no, I think he went to his grave, unfortunately, with the sense that he may have not achieved his goal, which was to, you know, prove the existence of these creatures, or at least convince his colleagues that it was something worthwhile to study. And I think that's what made, you know, his story a bit somber. I mean, at least for me.
Yeah. One thinks about that as one is, you know, finished the book and knowing that he's since died. I mentioned the travels that you've done for the book, and you know, I'm talking from Vancouver, and it's not terribly far from the Great Bear Rainforest. Right. Yet it's a place I've never been to, I don't think I would want to. I mean, I guess I should, but it's just not going to happen, right?
Okay.
So I read your book in the Valleys of the Noble Beyond, and it's a beautiful evocation of this place and why one should care about what's going on there. You mentioned a moment ago talking about the receding wild, the threatened wild, and I can't help but think, you know, as we're thinking about climate change, the relationship what you've studied in this book, what you've sought in this for this book, has with our future.
Well, I mean, the Great Bear Rainforest, which is essentially called the largest intact coastal temperate rainforest in the world, which it extends from, I guess, the latitude of, you know, the northern area of Vancouver Island, like the coastal area of BC, stretching up until the Alaska Panhandle. It's hundreds of kilometers long. It's an area of unfathomable beauty and sprawling forests and unimaginable marine life. And you've got bears, you've got, red cedar trees, you've got wolves, you've got every manner of flora and fauna there. And, if you could imagine a kind of a Jurassic Park type of place, I mean, I'm kind of simplifying it a little bit. I mean, this would be the area in the world that would kind of come close to something like that. And so, it's a potent symbol of not just, the need to conserve, but also what an intact, functioning, healthy ecosystem looks like and feels like and how it operates. And so, I think in times, in the present day when we are facing this kind of, looming extinction crisis, let's call it, a place like the Great Bear is representative of what we can strive to bring places back to, perhaps. It certainly does give you that feeling when you're back there that this is the way things are supposed to be and operate and function in terms of nature and in terms of an ecosystem.
Yeah, I was flipping through your book just preparing for a chat a day or two ago. And I remember it reminded me as I was flipping through the near the back of the book, you talk about the sensation that you feel traveling back into, say, the city, if you will, coming back from the wilderness.
Right.
And I found that, I remember reading that at the time and thinking just how profound that was, what a visceral experience that is for you. I mean, the noise itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, the trip that I recount in the book was around 3 months in length. It was, just to give context, through, very small communities in relation to where I'm from. I'm from Toronto, and so I'm talking to you right now from, like, the epicenter of downtown with all of its noise. But when you go to a place like that, coming from where I'm coming from, you after spending time there, you become really adjusted to the frequency of a place like the Great Bear. And a lot of the times that I spent there were not even in the towns. They were on boats or it was just the time in the bush or on the water. And it's incredibly calm and incredibly calming. And then suddenly, when my trip ended, I, of course, had to come back home, as you do when you end any trip. And there is always some kind of readjustment process, I think, when you go somewhere radically different than from where you're from. And in my case, it's often been, I'm of Middle Eastern extraction. I tend to travel quite a bit to places like Cairo and Beirut, which are these sorts of circuses of stimuli. And then when I come home, it tends to be that, Toronto is very quiet and very still and very kind of, underwhelming after coming from that place. But in this case, coming back from the Great Bear, it was completely the opposite. I just could not believe how sensitive I had become to being in a quiet place and how just daunting it was coming back to the city. And not just in terms of noises and the speed, but also the detachment of humans. Like, when you're anyone who's familiar with small towns will know how friendly they are and how everybody says hello and everyone is waving to each other and there's eye contact being made and just this kind of very, very, very human, profoundly human interpersonal relationships that you have, even if they're shallow and in passing. But when you come back here, just almost this kind of, this almost really, really unhealthy detachment and distance and almost kind of unhappiness and like a slog. And so it really affected me coming back. And I thought, you know, maybe one other way of describing the Great Bear, in addition to all the other ways I've written about it in the story, was to talk about its opposite, coming home.
Right. I mean, even just thinking about it as you're talking about it now, in a way, it sort of illustrates sort of how civilization has evolved, or in this case, devolved,
right.
and how people have gone from nature to these urban settings and not really thought about it, you know.
Right, and I think, you know, it has. I mean, trying to exist and live all the time in a big city with all of its demands and all of its stresses and all of its requirements, I think it denudes our humanness in a certain way. I mean, certainly at the interpersonal level, it does.
The title of the book is quite beautiful, and I'm wondering for you, the noble beyond. What does that mean for you?
Well, the term comes from a scene in the book where I meet with a character in a place called Ocean Falls, and he describes the Great Bear to me in his term, which he coins, you know, the noble beyond. And for him, you know, that means, he describes it as sort of meaning, you know, the realm of magic, metaphor, meaning, and imagination, you know, the beautiful and, you know, the intriguing intangibles of life. And you know, he cites, like, Joseph Campbell and Carlos Castaneda, and sort of he's a bit of a kind of, like, hippie in terms of his bent in terms of seeing the world. But the reason he brings it up is because he was taking me to task in terms of my black and white, either or approach to investigating the Sasquatch. And he says, well, you know, you're not really going to know the answer to this question. What really matters is what the Sasquatch means in the grand scheme of things. What is the meaning of the symbol? What is its significance? How does it fall into this kind of this zone of gray, this ether of subtler possibilities between black and white, which for him is the noble beyond? And so it's at that point in the journey where the story takes a hard turn, and then I begin to kind of look at Sasquatch in a different way. And therefore, I took that term to be the title of the book, representing not only the Great Bear Rainforest, not only the abode of the Sasquatch, but also that place in between polemics and polls and arguments, that gray zone where I think we lose sight of a lot of possibilities and a lot of perspectives and points of view that are harder to see. And that, for me, is the noble beyond.
It really is such a beautiful book. And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed reading it and talking to you today, John. By the way, this summer, where did you travel to?
I came back to British Columbia for 3 weeks, and I went up to Bella Bella for a couple of weeks, one of the places where I traveled to in the story of my book. So I went there on a separate trip, and then I returned in August and spent a few weeks in the Kootenays, so around Nelson, Cranbrook, Kimberley, that area.
That's the other thing to admire about the book. I mean, you mentioned Ocean Falls a moment ago. I mean, it's not a small town. It's a ghost town now.
Right.
It's a part of our history here in British Columbia. You've seen places in this province that a lot of us who live here haven't and ought to. And so your writing in this book and in other places is a marvelous way to look at it. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this, John.
Thanks so much for having me.
The book is called In the Valley of the Noble Beyond, In Search of the Sasquatch. It is published by Greystone Books. John Zada, its author, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.